Welcome back to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde. As always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. Thank you so much for tuning in. So this is a podcast largely about guitars. Usually I'm talking to guitar players who are incredibly inspiring or guitar makers who are doing something thoroughly unique. Sometimes I throw you a curveball. Last week, we talked about the lost jazz guitar legend Snoozer Quinn, who had the most troubled life imaginable. And today, I'm throwing you an even wilder curveball. I'm talking to a drummer. But it's a drummer I've known forever, and he's a dear friend, and his story is thoroughly fascinating. So I hope you enjoy it. Nabil Ayers was, in 1998, when I first moved to Seattle, the owner of the cool record store, Sonic Boom Records. I was a frequent customer at Sonic Boom Records back in the day, and I got to know Nabil pretty well, and then I would go see him play music with the Long Winters or Alien Crime Syndicate or a bunch of other bands. He was a drummer, and I probably bumped into Nabil on a weekly basis for many years of my life. Nabil and his then business partner, Jason Hughes, ended up selling their record store to one of their customers. Sonic Boom Records still exists, and it's about 200 yards away from where I am sitting here at the Fretboard Journal. I've followed Nabil throughout his career. He ended up moving to New York, running 4AD Records, and then he got promoted and became the U.S. president for the entire Beggars Group of labels, which is a pretty big deal in the music industry. I felt like I knew Nabil pretty well, but there's one big facet of his life I had no clue about. Nabil's dad is the jazz musician Roy Ayers, and that is the subject of Nabil's new book, My Life in the Sunshine. I read this book, it just came out on Viking Press this week, and I thoroughly loved it. It was moving, it was interesting. It shed a whole new light on somebody that I personally know, but also it sort of provided a template for how to be inclusive, how to be a good parent, how to be a bad parent, and how to discover yourself. I really, really cannot recommend this book enough. The big news here at the Fretboard Journal's tiny headquarters are, A, our 50th issue is now out and mailing to subscribers around the world. Not everyone will have seen it by the time this podcast airs. The U.S. Postal Service is taking sometimes 1 to 2 to 3 weeks to deliver magazines, but it's a beautiful issue. I got to interview one of my guitar heroes for this issue, Lee Rinaldo of Sonic Youth, but there's also features on Bela Fleck and James Blood Ulmer and all of this other great stuff. Our magazine covers the entire spectrum of acoustic and electric guitar playing and guitar collecting. We really get to go deep and have some fun and make meaningful connections. And a lot of our readers actually write some of my favorite pieces. So please, if anyone out there is sitting on a great story and you think it would make for a great Fretboard Journal article or maybe a photo essay, hit me up, jason@fretboardjournal.com. Before we talk to Nabil, we do have a couple of sponsors that I want to give a shout out to. Our friends at Calton Cases make the greatest flight cases imaginable. We just gave away a Calton flight case with our 50th issue to one lucky subscriber. And I just love this brand more than you can imagine. If you're a touring musician and you have one guitar that you depend on, you need to protect it as best as possible, and Calton has you covered. Reach out to them. They're based down in Austin, Texas now, and they're doing incredible work. We are also brought to you by our friends at Peghead Nation. I have been taking the roots music classes of Scott Nygaard, as well as some of the jazz guitar classes that Matt Munisteri offers. You too can learn from some of my favorite instructors. Just go to Peghead Nation. You can get your first month free or $20 off any annual subscription by just using the promo code FRETBOARD when you check out. Our friends at iZotope are still offering a great discount if you want to check out any of their audio software to clean up any of the audio glitches that you might have encountered in old recordings or new recordings or whatever. Use the coupon code FRET10 when you check out at iZotope. You will save 10%. And last but definitely not least, our friends at Retrofret Vintage Guitars over in New York City, one of my favorite guitar stores in the entire world, because they, on a weekly basis, get cooler guitars than pretty much anywhere else in the world. Right now, they've got an Olympic White 1962 Fender Jaguar. They've got a 65 Gibson Firebird 3 with the Inverness green paint on it. Incredible custom color. And then if anybody out there just wants a player's grade Martin, they've got a beautiful But, you know, it's been around the block a few times. Martin 018 from 1949. Pretty good deal on that one. I'm sure it sounds fantastic. As always, if you hit up Retrofret and want to inquire about any of their guitars, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you so they know that this podcast is working. The only other big news I want to remind you of is the Fretboard Summit is taking place August 25th to 27th at the Old Town School of Folk Music. This is basically the guitar nerds version of the TED Talks. So many people who have been in the pages of our magazine will be there. We've got Courtney Hartman, Nathan Salzberg, and James Elkington doing workshops. We have rare guitars, new and old, that people will be able to try out. You can try bracing a guitar if you want to learn from Dana Bourgeois how to brace a top. We've got all these people converging on Chicago for one weekend, and it's really a giant party and celebration of all things guitar. I hope you will come. And now, without further ado, I get to reconnect with an old friend, Nabil Ayers, on the Fretboard Journal podcast. Again, the book is called My Life in the Sunshine. You're going to hear all about it, but I highly recommend it.
So, Nabil,
I've known you I moved to Seattle in 1998, and I feel like you were a fixture of my music nerddom when I lived in Seattle, and I was just moved up there, and I've known you forever, and I did not know any of the stuff that you wrote about in this book. So,
that's some of the weirdness of my life right now, and my weird fear that surrounds the book is not that I'm going to piss people off, but more that I have a lot of friends who are going to say, you know, I just read this and I've known you for whatever, 10, 20, 30 years, and I never knew any of this, because this is all kind of, it's not that I've been holding it in, it's that it's just not, I haven't made it part of my story because I don't feel like talking about it. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, how often in the social context of a rock club are you talking about your dad,
you know, right, or anything? Well, I mean, so more than I like. Sometimes, but
I'll give you a hall pass for that. But yeah, I mean, you were always, you know, you were the co-founder of Sonic Boom Records, which still exists with new owners a block away from where the Fretboard Journal is.
So crazy. It's turning 25 this year.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And you were always just the happy guy who worked at the record store, and I'd run into you at all the shows.
That is definitely who I was for a long time.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, you've obviously lived with this your whole life. Like, why did the book, I want to get to what the book is about, but why now on the book? Like, what stars aligned that made this thing happen?
Right. It's weird. It's largely about my father and my non-relationship with my father, which to me has never been a negative thing in my life. I mean, my mother was really young. She was 21, decided she wanted to have a child with this guy, Roy Ayers, who she'd met a few times, barely dated. I would use that term loosely. And so would she. And she just said to him, look, I want to have your baby. And felt like she knew that the second she met him. And he said yes. And, you know, he's not going to be part of it. Everyone agreed. And that was the plan. So I've always known that. And that is how I grew up without him. And it was never divorce. It was never, he left us. It was none of those things that, you know, make for a sad, rejected child. And I had incredible male role models and a really great childhood. And it was always kind of there, but I didn't feel like I was missing anything. And so that's the sort of short version of not feeling angry about my father ever, but just he's always kind of been there because people ask me about him a lot, because I look like him, because I have the same last name, because I work in music. And he's a lot more present these days. But I think what really happened, what sort of turned into the book, is 5 or 6 years ago, I just started writing for some reason. And I'd never been a writer, really liked to write in college, but that was a long time ago. And just started writing short things. And the first thing I published was when we sold Sonic Boom, the record store, in 2016. We were trying to decide how to kind of announce that to, not to the world, but to Seattle, to our friends, and make it a positive thing. And we sold it to a customer, and everyone's really happy. So I had written a bunch of short stories about the store just for fun. Everything I'd written was for fun. And I published it in The Stranger, and that sort of served as the announcement. It was kind of this short memories of the early days of Sonic Boom story, and just got tons of great feedback. But it wasn't so much like, wow, you're a great writer. It was just like, oh, wow, I met my husband at the store. Thank you so much. It was more just like, almost didn't have anything to do with the writing, but it was the fact that I put something out there and got something back was really fun. And I think that's what kind of kept me going with writing. And that's right when I started to date now my wife, AJ, and she comes from the publishing world and she knows my story. And she's like, yeah, yeah, this is really fun. You can write about your record store and write about your crazy band stories and everything. But really what you need to write about is your father and your race, because that's what you care about. And that's what people will care about. Hmm. And it was this very, it was almost like she rehearsed it. It was such a great like statement. And it made me feel kind of terrible. And that's how I knew immediately that she was right. Because that's sort of what any creative thing, I think it's good when something makes you feel bad. The idea wasn't to feel bad for a long time, but it made me really think like, oh, that's scary. That's emotional. That's going to be hard. She's probably right. And that's when I started writing.
And what was that process like? Because writing about anything that's close to home is always kind of thin ice sometimes.
Yeah.
And you had only written kind of shorter form stories. Like, yep. How did you, was it just like, I'm just going to download my diary, or how did you go about
that? Not
this?
Totally. I mean, I was in a really good mindset because, you know, I have a job. I run a record company. It's not, I wasn't writing for a living and I wasn't trying to write for a living. So I was really lucky in that way. And I was managing to get things published like by then and like the New York Times and like crazy places. But it was always truly on my own terms, meaning like I was writing things because I felt like it. And if I got to a point where I thought, huh, maybe somebody could publish this, I would just blind email people and pitch it. And I got rejected so many more times than I've published things. But no one ever said, hey, will you write something for us? Or, hey, write something about your dad, or, you know, here's a deadline. None of that existed. So it was all really completely up to me and whatever I wanted to do. And I knew that. So when I started writing about my father and my life, it was almost even easier because there's this part of me that's like, no one's ever going to see this. It does not matter. I'm just doing this for fun. Who knows what it'll lead to? Maybe it'll turn into something else or something about music or whatever. So I just started writing about each of the times that I could remember meeting my father, which was like 4 or 5. And when I ran out of those, I started writing about the stories my mother had told me about the times I'd met my father that I didn't remember. And when I ran out of those, I started writing about the times I was somewhere and heard his music, which has happened a lot over the years. And once that was all done, which is probably a couple months, I was really writing a lot at the time. I was really into it. My wife was starting a company. So on weekends, she was busy and I would just go to this library and just type. And it was really easy. It was sort of cathartic. And at a certain point, there was a lot of stuff there. And it was on this timeline that was over, you know, 40 plus years of my life. And that's when I think I said to myself, like, oh, wow, I wonder if this could be a book. There's like, you know, a beginning and a middle and an end. And a lot of the stuff that should be really hard is already done.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up. I mean, there's no way. I think it's 301 pages. There's if someone said like, hey, will you write a 301 page book about your father and your life and race? It's due on this date. Go. No way.
Yeah.
It had to happen the way it happened, which is maybe why it took so long.
Yeah. And it's an amazing book. I mean, I learned a lot, obviously, about you. Right. You learn a little bit about your dad too, but you're in the dark largely like the rest of us about your dad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an amazing, you know, there's just this kind of like crazy parallel universe thing where, you know, he's playing a show a block away from where you live in Seattle and Nectar and stuff like that.
Yeah.
What does he know that this book exists?
I don't know. I imagine he will soon. I mean, it's fine. We're not on bad terms. We're just on no terms. You know, I never see him. He for a while, he just sort of stopped calling me back and that's where we are. But we both live in New York. He's in the same city. I often think I might run into him or into my half sister, who I also don't know, his daughter who lives in New York. But I am loosely in touch with, his name is Mtume, who is my half brother, who is sort of, there are two kids that are younger than I am who actually grew up with him, who are, you know, he's still married to their mother. And so maybe 5-6 months ago, when the book was kind of ready to at least start eking its way out into the world, I just emailed him, Mtume, Roy's son, and said, hey, I wrote this book. This is happening. It's coming out in June. There's a lot of Roy in it. It's not, you know, certainly not like a takedown piece. There's some ups and some downs, but in the end, I think it's really positive. And you're mentioned and your sister is mentioned. And if you, you know, I'm not in touch with either of them. I don't know how to be in touch with either of them, but if you want to see it or if you want to let them know, let me know and I'll send it to you. And he replied really nicely, just like, wow, that's great. Congratulations. Didn't ask for it. It's weird because I feel like, I mean, everyone asks me that question and I feel like that's all I can do. I mean, how hard, yeah. Especially if you've read the book, I mean, how hard do I need to try to give it to him? I've done everything I can. I've offered it to the one person who's close to him that I know.
Wow. That's heavy. I mean, and he's not portrayed in a necessarily negative light. There were a couple moments where like he didn't mm-hmm. really want to hang with you because he was about to go to a show or something.
Right.
But it was, there was no scandalous gossip or anything.
No, I don't think so. I think it's actually, I mean, in the end, I think it's, well, in the book and in my life, I think I'm really pretty thankful for everything I got from him. And that's kind of, it takes, you know, it's a road to get there, but that's definitely where I get by the end of the book.
Yeah. I mean, even if he wasn't, even if your dad was not a famous jazz musician and you didn't have that DNA, like you were immersed in music pretty early on. Everything aligned for you to like become an indie rock drummer and to run a record label. It's pretty amazing.
That was it. I know. I've always felt really lucky. I mean, there was a point at which there was Sonic Boom, The Stores. I was in The Long Winters and other bands and putting out records on my label and doing all those things at the same time, which is incredible.
Yeah.
So lucky. It's so fun. And never felt like I had a real job. I mean, Sonic Boom did sometimes. And when we were big and had 3 stores and 23 employees, that was the hardest it was just because people are hard.
Being a manager is hard. I know. Or maybe I'm just not a good manager. But I mean, what were those pivotal early exposures to music that set you into being turned you on to being a drummer?
There's one that's not in the book that my mother only told me about fairly recently. I don't know if you know who this guy is, Marzette Watts, mm-hmm. who died in the 90s. He has 2 incredible albums that came out in, I think, 67 and 69, both like pretty, you know, outsider, free jazz, avant-garde, downtown New York records. He's a saxophone player, but also a painter who went to the Sorbonne, was like this serious activist in the South who the governor kicked out of Alabama under threat of arrest. Just like this really like incredible, amazing figure. And my mother was friends with him in New York and his family. And apparently, right when I was born, like a week later, Marzette came by with his wife and this African drum and said to my mother, "Hey, I heard you had a kid. Congratulations. He's going to be a drummer. Here's this drum."
Whoa.
And so the question is, wow, how did he know that? Or wow, he did that. Or like, who knows, right?
Yeah. And did you grow up with that drum?
Yeah, like, there's lots of pictures. I remember it really well. I mean, I had it for a long time as a kid. There's lots of pictures of me with it. I mean, I beat it to complete shit. It was like this kind of furry, like, probably animal skin, leathery brown drum. And that, I think, is why my uncle bought me a real drum set when I was 2, because I was playing this thing so much. He was like, okay, I guess it's time to step it up a notch.
Yeah.
Incredible. So that was, but it wasn't just that. I mean, it was just, I mean, my mother is a dancer. Alan, my uncle, her brother, is an incredible jazz saxophone player. And that's, you know, he was my father figure. He was who I was really around as a kid. And we played music together all the time. We have pictures from that. We have tapes of me playing drums when I'm 3 and he's, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
20 or whatever, however old he would have been then, 22 or something like that, like really crazy stuff. So that's the sort of argument. And I talk about that a bit in the book, where is it DNA? Is it from my dad just because he's a musician, even though I got no exposure to that? Or is it from my mother's side and these people who, I mean, my mother bought me so many records and took me so many concerts. And my uncle played music with me and literally gave me instruments. So I don't know if there's a way to figure it out, but it was definitely always, always present from day one.
Yeah. I mean, I loved that. I mean, I also, you know, the book goes obviously deeper than just music because you're trying to figure out your identity and your race and you're kind of trying to fit in. I mean, you moved to Salt Lake City where you kind of don't fit in, and then you moved to Seattle where you totally fit in, I guess.
I figured out a way to. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, throughout you have, I mean, even when I remember your record store days, you've had this sort of like super upbeat attitude. I guess there's this scenario where, you know, having that identity issue, you could have turned bitter and mad, but you've always just been super upbeat. Is that
right?
The way you were raised, or did that just come naturally to you? You don't know.
I think so. And I mean, now, you know, only recently here, I mean, since sort of finishing the book and getting it out there a bit, I'm talking to so many people who actually not necessarily are like close with my father, but who at least have a few stories about him or who have met him and spent time with him. And I'm learning so much more about him and sort of in that process, realizing how alike we are in a lot of ways. And I do think that's one of those qualities that he has. And I remember that from when I met him and saw him and even from pictures and videos, but I think some of that too, I think those, you know, Salt Lake and even Seattle and those places could have been harder for me if I didn't have this really sort of amazing solid base that I attribute to my mom for having me in New York City. And then we moved a lot, but we were in Cambridge, Massachusetts and Amherst, Massachusetts specifically, which, you know, exactly where we were at the time in the 70s was like this crazy, just like perfect oasis where there's nothing weird about me at all. Even though my father's black, my mother's white, she was young and single and we were on welfare and he wasn't in the picture. And that was completely the norm in this. It was this university family housing development at UMass. And there are something like 200 or 300 families there. And that was the deal. Most kids didn't have a father there, tons of different races. Like it just wasn't a thing. No one had money. So till I was 10, that's what the world was. There's nothing. I mean, it was really like, so, I mean, we had TVs, we knew that there was other stuff out there, but I was never weird. And so then we moved to New York and that was still great. And then when we moved to Salt Lake, I think I just had enough confidence and enough of a base that, you know, we've got to make it work. And if I had 10 years of being made fun of or being called names, I think it would have been a lot harder to move to Salt Lake, but I had 10 years of not being the weird kid. So why should I start now? I think was kind of the attitude.
As part of your process writing this, did you go back and revisit all these places?
Oh, that's interesting. Not Salt Lake. No, I'm going there too, and I'm really excited to go back. Amherst. Yes. I went to Amherst with my mother, her best friend. So there's a woman in the book who I talk about, Diane, and she's actually the woman who took the picture of me on the cover when I was a kid. It was Diane's 70th birthday. Diane still lives in Amherst. So we went back and then the next day went to North Village, this development I'm talking about, the place where we all lived and like walked around. And it was just so weird. I don't know if you've ever been back to a childhood home and like everything looked small because I was big and these buildings that used to tower over me, all that kind of stuff. But what was most interesting was not so much the setting, but being there with my mother and having her start remembering things and talking about things and telling stories and that kind of stuff. And that's probably when I was definitely writing, but maybe wasn't officially writing the book, but I'm sure some of the stuff from that came through.
Did you get a sense of like, has the demographic changed much since you were there?
It's crazy. It has not. So, so soon after that, somehow, I think Diane sent my mom and me the announcement that they were tearing it down and it was supposed to be, I mean, they built it in like 1972 and it was supposed to last for 10 years and it lasted for almost 50. They were tearing it down. And so I wrote about it because that's what I was doing at the time. I was like, oh, wow, I have feelings about this. So I'm going to write about them. And it was this piece. I was like, you know, I don't know who's going to care about this. Let me just like do some Googling and found this Amherst cool community newspaper called like the North Adams Gazette. It's not the North Adams Gazette, the something Gazette, really great, like, you know, smallish town paper. Yeah. And just called, emailed the editor and they were great. And they were like, yeah, we'd love to run it. We don't, you know, we can't pay you or anything, which was another luxury. I didn't care. I just wanted that to exist. Yeah. And so they ran it in this smallish paper and online. And that might be the biggest actual personal response I've ever gotten from any piece I've written, bigger than writing about Nirvana and Rolling Stone or writing about for the New York Times, just because it was crazy. It was generations of people emailing me saying, I lived there from 95 to 97 and it was exactly the same. I live there from 2015 and I have to move out now. And it's exactly the same as you describe it. Like it's this crazy place. And it was really touching and moving to get all those emails. And I was sharing them all with the editor. It was a really crazy process. But I mean, not, you know, like we're talking about 20 emails, but 20 emails. It's kind of a lot. You know, not like Twitter likes, but actual like letters.
From people. Yeah. People actually took the effort. Mm-hmm. It's wild.
But they all said the exact same thing. It was really crazy.
They all had a great...
Yep.
So what's the secret? Just that it's dominated by moms?
I wonder, right? Maybe. I mean, it's... Because it wasn't technically... I always thought it was low-income family housing. It wasn't. It was just family housing. But I think it just happened that because it was so cheap, it was a lot of low-income people who lived there.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's just that... Like lots of neighborhoods and things in the world, the people who live there create the next generation of people who live there. They tell their friends and they tell other families, and it kind of evolves in a way that it sort of stays the same in a good way.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was really crazy.
So we talked about Roy not seeing this book. How much of your extended family has seen this book?
Not a lot. There are a lot of people in it. Anyone who has anything in it, and this was quite a process, you know, if it was like people from work at 4AD or whatever, I emailed them just that part and said, does this sound right? Is anything in here factually wrong? Is there anything in here you don't like? You know, sort of gave everyone the opportunity to just sort of say what they wanted. I mean, my mom, of course, had tons of things to say, but that was a longer thing.
How was she about it?
She was great. I mean, okay. I didn't let anyone read it until it was really... so done that I knew things wouldn't change, because I didn't want my mom to say, oh, you took out the part about this. And I knew things would still happen. Sure. So it was really, really close. And then my editor gave me 30 days to like close it with everybody. Wow. So my mom had some things to say, you know, mostly good, but there's a funny thing that she really wanted me to take out that I fought to keep in and that stayed in, and that I'm really, really happy it did, as is everyone who read it. I don't want to give it away.
Okay. You don't have to.
Can't spoil it. but the extended family, with some of those people, I mean, my thing is that I really want, especially people I care about and people who are involved, to read the whole thing when it's done. I think this is a lot like being in a band and not wanting to play demos for people or anything. Sure. It's like when we have the mastered album, you can listen to it from start to finish. So with some of those people, with some of my bandmates, with you know, some of Roy's, my family that I've gotten to know in the last couple of years, I said to them, you know, when this is coming, you know about it. I will send you your parts if you want. They're positive. I would rather you just read the whole thing when it's finished, but let me know. And anyone who I said that to said, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And so those family members, I remember Rory, who's in the book, she replied, surprise us. Was the surprise or the reply.
Yeah. So, you know, having gone through this process, having lived the life that you do, I mean, most of us, including those of us who kind of grew up with just a mom, like, you know, we might remember our dad's voice, or maybe we just remember how they look.
Right.
But you have this, you know, music to remind you all the time about
and that's
presence.
The only thing. Yeah, that replaces the voice or the stories.
What is your reaction when you hear a Roy Ayers tune at this point?
At this point, it's a bit of laughter because it happens so often. It's really crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you probably notice it. I mean, you would notice it.
It's because I live in Brooklyn and spend time in LA or whatever. But it's like, I mean, it's not weird for it to happen twice in a week right now, which seems like kind of a lot.
Yeah,
and I mean, and it's also possible to go a month, but I mean, it's in TV commercials and TV shows. And sometimes, I mean, I'll just hear a car driving by. Like, it's really wild. I'll hear it in Old Navy. I mean, it's crazy. So it happens often enough. And I've also got, I mean, that's kind of a weird, not weird, but like a narrative in the book. Like the way I feel when I hear that song is kind of representative of the way I feel when I think of him. And that changes throughout the book. And it's gotten to a point where now it's pretty positive. I still feel a bit of like, oh shit, is anybody looking at me when I hear it? Which obviously makes no sense. There's, you know, if I'm at Old Navy, no one's looking at me, but I feel that way.
Yeah.
And it's just a strange connection.
Totally. Are you drumming anymore?
Not really. I mean, I don't have a drum set in New York, which is too bad, but it just doesn't really work there. So I still have two drum sets. One is at a friend's house in LA and one is at a friend's house in Nashville. once in a while, every few months at the most, I'll go to this. There's a studio like not too far from my house and just like play along with headphones, put on records and, you know, rent 2 hours or whatever. But the drag is that the drums are really shitty in the studio. It's like, it's a lot less fun
to Got it. Play
shitty drums. But it's still fun. But once in a while, I mean, I don't know if you remember the band Micro Mini I was in with Lance Payne. Lance is still a good friend, and he does these cover band benefit shows every year or two in Nashville where he lives. And so it's fun to go down there and do that. We did his 50th birthday party. I was in a band with him last September in Nashville, and we played like a bunch of 80s songs.
Yeah.
Which is pretty fun. But no, I mean, generally, no.
You're just too busy. Drums. You're writing books, running a record label.
Right, exactly. Who's got time?
Well, Nabil, thank you so much. The books, My Life in the Sunshine, I'll include a link in the show notes, as they often say.
Thank you, Jason.
I totally loved it. I mean, it's great to revisit someone from my past and see what they're up to. And it was a great book, you know, even if I didn't know you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. It's really good to reconnect.
All right, that was my chat with Nabil Ayers. I hope you enjoyed it. We've got more great podcasts coming. We have some surprise guests over the next week or two. Please subscribe to our podcast if you haven't yet. Leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or however you digest your podcasts. And keep the feedback coming to podcast@fretboardjournal.com.